Welcome. I'm Eric Fleming, host of A Moment with Eric Fleming, the podcast of our time. I want to personally thank you for listening to the podcast. If you like what you're hearing, then I need you to do a few things. First, I need subscribers. I'm on Patreon at patreon.com/A Moment with Eric Fleming. Your subscription allows an independent podcaster like me the freedom to speak truth to power and to expand and improve the show. Second, leave a 5-star review for the podcast on the streaming service you listen to it. That will help the podcast tremendously. Third, go to the website, momenteric.com. There you can subscribe to the podcast, leave reviews and comments, listen to past episodes, and even learn a little bit about your host. Lastly, don't keep this a secret like it's your own personal guilty pleasure. Tell someone else about the podcast. Encourage others to listen to the podcast and share the podcast on your social media platforms, because it is time to make this moment a movement. Thanks in advance for supporting the podcast of our time. I hope you enjoy this episode as well. Hello, and welcome to another Moment with Eric Fleming. I am your host, Eric Fleming. And we've got a great podcast for you today. I'm glad to have y'all listening in, especially during these interesting times where you've got a former president in a criminal trial, you have shots fired in the Middle East. I know there's a lot of things that people are dealing with, and a lot of people are paying things that they are paying attention to, hopefully these guests coming on will enlighten you on some issues that they're going to talk about. And even though it's going to be a political conversation, kind of escape from some of the negative stuff that we're dealing with. And just understand that even though there's some things that are hitting the headlines, there's some stuff that we still need to work on in this country. And it doesn't really matter what viewpoint you have on it. Again, the role of this podcast is to make sure that you get as many viewpoints as possible so that your viewpoint will be an educated one. All right. So having said all that, let's kick this off with a moment of news from Grace G.
Thanks, Eric. The first criminal trial involving a former U.S. president began April 15th as jury selection commenced in Donald Trump's hush money trial. The U.S. House of Representatives transmitted articles of impeachment on Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the U.S. Senate. The Senate quickly dismissed the charges, citing they were unconstitutional. President Biden informed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the U.S. would not support a counteroffensive against Iran following an Iranian attack on Israeli territory. Iran launched the attack over a suspected Israeli strike on its embassy compound in Syria. Donald Trump endorsed House Speaker Mike Johnson amidst internal Republican dissent. Trump criticized Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene for threatening to oust Johnson over disagreements on Ukraine aid and other issues. The U.S. Supreme Court allowed a Black Lives Matter activist to be sued by a police officer injured during a 2016 protest. The U.S. Equal Opportunity Commission announced a rule stating employers' obligations to accommodate workers' pregnancies extends to abortions and contraception use. President Biden spoke at the National Action Network Conference, highlighting his administration's efforts to narrow the racial wealth gap, which has seen significant improvement under his policies. The state of California sued Huntington Beach, alleging the city's new voter identification law violates state law. A bipartisan group of U.S. senators introduced a bill to renew the African Growth and Opportunity Act for 16 years until 2041. a global survey by Glocalities indicated a rise in pessimism and a shift towards more liberal views worldwide, except among young American men who have become more conservative. And a Pew Research Center survey revealed that most U.S. teachers worry about the possibility of a shooting at their school. I am Grace G., and this has been A Moment of News.
All right. Thank you, Grace, for that moment of news. And now it is time for our first guest. And his name is Kevin A. Sabet, Dr. Kevin A. Sabet, an affiliate of the Institution for Social and Policy Studies and the Medical School at Yale University, and dubbed by NBC News as the prodigy of drug politics, and by Salon as the quarterback of the new anti-drug movement, author, consultant, and advisor to three U.S. presidential administrations. Kevin A. Sabet has studied, researched, written about, and implemented drug policy for over 25 years. He is the only person appointed by Republican and Democrats to work at the White House Drug Office. Kevin is currently the president and CEO of the Foundation for Drug Policy Solutions, FDPS, and SAM, Smart Approaches to Marijuana, two nonprofit organizations he founded with Congressman Patrick Kennedy. His latest book, Smokescreen, What the Marijuana Industry Doesn't Want You to Know, distributed by Simon & Schuster, won the Next Generation Indie Book Award in the social justice category and has been optioned for a documentary film. His upcoming book, One Nation Under the Influence, will be published by Polity in 2025. He regularly publishes op-eds, and his work has been seen in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and other publications. He is also a regular columnist for Newsweek. He received his doctorate and master's degrees from Oxford University and a BA from the University of California, Berkeley. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct honor and privilege to have as a guest on this podcast, Dr. Kevin A. Sabet. All right, Dr. Kevin Sabet, how you doing, sir? You doing good?
Doing well, Eric. Thanks so much for having me. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. And it's really, really an honor for me to have you on. You have been a national figure when it comes to dealing with drug policy. So to for you to come on my little old podcast, I'm deeply honored to have you on.
Well, you have a great show. I was able to check it out, so I'm honored to be on myself.
Well, thank you, sir. What I'd like to do is start off with a quote. And it may be something you may have said, something you wrote or relating to the topic. So your quote is, make no mistake about it. Legalization is not about, you know, Cheech and Chong smoking marijuana or, you know, a Grateful Dead concert. It's about creating the next Marlboro of our time, the next Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds, the big tobacco all over again. Talk to me about that quote.
Yeah, no, it's money. Unfortunately, driving this move to normalize drug use, starting with marijuana, but don't get me wrong, it will not stop there and it hasn't stopped there. We're talking now about mushrooms, psychedelics, LSD, ecstasy, giving pills to people addicted to heroin, giving them, you know, deadly pain pills. But you know, that quote was in the context of marijuana, although it could be applied to anything, because you know, I hear a lot of reasons why we should legalize from very enlightened people, reasons about social justice and the war on drugs, reasons about tax revenue, reasons about, you know, well, maybe they'll keep it away from kids because, you know, you don't drug dealers don't ask for ID. Right. So but the storefront does. A lot of things that sound really good, actually, on their face. And I don't disagree with even some of the premises. We can get into the war on drugs issue in particular. But the real reason this is even advancing, the real motivation and the outcome, not only just the motivation, but the outcome is money for a small number of people. And it's the story that we've seen in America time and time again when it comes to really any addictive product, which is really any product in particular at all. You try and increase use as much as possible, whether that's safe or not. So, you know, if you're, and then you lie about it, by the way, you lie about if there's anything wrong with it. You don't want ever to, for there to be the impression that there's something wrong with your product. So that's why we see Boeing, you know, saying that there was nothing wrong with their product until a door fell off and people almost died. And people did die 4 or 5 years ago with the original system that they released, right, with the multiple crashes in Southeast Asia. You have, you know, Volkswagen that, you know, basically goosed their engines. There was a huge issue with the diesel engines and they hit it forever. But I think the most notorious in our history is tobacco. And that's why I talked about Philip Morris and Marlboro, whether it's the menthol cigarettes targeting the Black community, but beyond that, just targeting young people, targeting anybody vulnerable so they could get a lifelong customer because it was about money. And I don't think we should expect marijuana to be any different. Why would that be different? Because all of a sudden we're more enlightened than we were 30 years ago? No, it's because it's about money. It's about a small number of people, frankly, that look a lot like me, not like you, Eric, that are making the money, even though they're pretending that it's about people like you. And it's just, frankly, I find it insulting. That isn't anything to say about also the harms of it, which they're not even talking about. This is a fundamentally different drug today. So that's really the depth of what I meant there with the quote.
So what happened at UC Berkeley to lead you on this path of drug policy activism?
Well, it actually happened before that even. I grew up in a mainly white, middle upper class neighborhood in Orange County, California. It wasn't the richest, the OC that you see on TV with the beachfront mansions, but it also wasn't the traditionally poorer side of Santa Ana with the huge influx of Mexican immigrants. It was sort of in between, but it was, you know, middle upper class. And it was a place that, you know, certainly wanted to identify with the upper class and with the white, you know, coastal neighborhoods, not with the inland Latino neighborhoods. And that's important. I say that because drugs was something that my community wanted to pretend didn't exist, really. And interestingly, it was a far right wing libertarian. I mean, so far right that it's, you know, we don't want anything to do with government, libertarian school board that essentially cut off programs for kids my age that were helping them deal with issues like drugs, you know, obviously including alcohol. Alcohol's a drug. I noticed that was happening, and that really rubbed me the wrong way. I never had alcohol or drugs in my family. I'm not in recovery myself. You know, I don't have that kind of story that I can, you know, talk about. But I saw it all around me, and I saw some really bad things happening. And I wanted to increase the awareness. And I basically got the door slammed in my face. We don't want to talk about this. And I really pushed the issue a lot. I was just that kind of kid. And I wanted to get out of Orange County as far away as I could. By the time I was 18, I just was disillusioned with the environment and what was happening. And of course, now I look back, you know, 25 years later, well, man, you know, I took that 75 degree sunny weather and 10 minute proximity to Disneyland and 10 minute proximity to the beach. I took that for granted. You don't realize what you have, I think, at the time, right? But at the time, and I just wanted to get out of there. And so I wanted to go to a place that was actually ideologically opposite and see what that was like. So that's why I went to Berkeley. And when I went to Berkeley, I was equally as startled with what I saw and experienced, but it was in a different way. So in Orange County, it was the lack of action. You know, I wanted to shake people sometimes. Hey, we got to wake up. This is an issue. And I just sort of, that's what I felt like. In Berkeley, it was the opposite. It was what I saw, what just astounded me. And it wasn't the lack of something. It was all the things that were there. And at the time, it was marijuana shops popping up everywhere because the state had voted for medical marijuana when I was in high school. And interestingly enough, I was inclined to be in favor of medical marijuana because I thought it was about cancer patients and I have cancer in my family. That was the TV commercial. It was a cancer patient. I'll never forget that TV commercial. And when you peel back the onion, you saw that it wasn't about cancer. And now, you know, 30 years later, we chuckle because, you know, a 19-year-old with a hangnail or a headache and get a medical marijuana card in almost every state in this country. So it's a joke about what that was. But I was so, you know, this, I was saying, wait a minute, this is not about medicine. This is about full legalization. And I dug deeper and found it was about a few billionaires who invested in this and wanted to make money. And I was just sickened by that. And so at Berkeley, I saw that up front. And I thought, you know, what a contrast, because here you have the hippie movement, the socialist movement, the free speech movement, people who hated corporate America, and they were unknowingly walking into the biggest corporate trap of that time. And I thought, wow, okay, something is amiss here. And I started talking with people, and they just didn't really understand what I was saying. A lot of people like didn't agree with me. But then I had a lot of people that did agree with me kind of quietly. So we started a group called Citizens for a Drug-Free Berkeley, which I like to joke was about as popular as the Coalition for a Wine-Free France. but the reality was actually there was a lot of supporters, but they were in the shadows. They were afraid to talk. They were very happy to have me kind of talk up front. And I got a lot of backlash for that. I got, threatening calls and emails and some things I had to report. I that's kind of where I developed my thick skin. And I really enjoyed my time there, though. It was a wonderful time for discussions and debates and ideas, but it wasn't without cost. I mean, there were some scary moments, I guess, in this issue, dealing with this issue. We used to go to raves and nightclubs and pass out postcards of your brain, of actually your brain on drugs, like real, like your actual picture of your brain, what it looks like when it is addicted to drugs and using drugs. And that time it was MDMA, ecstasy, because the late 90s was a big time people will remember for raves and ecstasy use. So it wasn't just about marijuana, but we used to go do that and walk in the not greatest parts of San Francisco at, you know, midnight. And I don't think my parents knew much about it. Thank God they would have killed me. But that's kind of where I developed my thick skin and my thoughts about this.
So Vice President Harris recently said that no one should go to jail for smoking weed and has asked the Health and Human Services and the Department of Justice to quickly change the scheduling for marijuana. You publicly stated earlier in the year that President Biden is not in favor of legalizing marijuana and that you were skeptical the rescheduling would happen. Do you still think your assessment on Biden's position or the rescheduling will happen before the election?
Well, on the first part, I mean, nothing's changed. President Biden's been pretty clear that he's against marijuana legalization, full scale. That's different than what his vice president thinks. But he thinks that, and he's the boss, and he's a leader of the Democratic Party. And, you know, I've had so many Democrats kind of in the closet on this issue to me, at least quietly tell me, including a former very, sort of household name that I just talked to yesterday, who ran for president. And I'll keep him nameless so that he doesn't get in trouble for this. Basically telling me, he told me that his position's reversed. He used to be in favor, but it's so bad now. He sees it so proliferating and so commercialized that he's against what we're doing with legalization. And the president's been against it and been pretty strong on it. So, I do stand by that. In terms of rescheduling, I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball about what's going to happen. But people need to understand that rescheduling does not mean legalizing. So that's interesting that the terms of the debate have actually changed. And now the industry will take anything that they can get. I mean, because they've got nothing on the federal level ever. And so they will take anything they can get. And so, you know, for the industry, actually, it does help them because it actually gives them tax write-offs so they can advertise their gummies and ice creams and kid-friendly sodas and edibles and oils. And, you know, today's marijuana is 30 to 40 times stronger than the marijuana of even 15 years ago. They can advertise these concentrates. They can advertise all of it and get a tax write-off. So they're very excited about that. I think that what's interesting is that the groups that I usually spar against about the merits of legalization, they're actually against the rescheduling of marijuana. And they want it to be legalized. That's why they're against it. So they're against it for different reasons. But even they understand that rescheduling is just a giveaway to this industry, and they're against that. And kudos to them for actually saying it's not about headlines for us. Because the headline's going to be, if they do it, you know, marijuana reclassified. People are going to think that means legalization. I mean, no one's following the fine print here. I mean, no one, the vast majority of Americans are not following it. So kudos to actually them that I normally am sparring with We just have a genuine disagreement about whether legalization is good or not. But at least they're even admitting, yeah, this isn't even going to legalize it. This is not what we want either. So it's an interesting discussion that's happening.
So Patrick Kennedy has been a major ally of yours in this fight. Yet his cousin, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., said that he wants to decriminalize marijuana, create safe banking laws for the cannabis business, which that rescheduling would help, and create a federal tax while also legalizing some psychedelic drugs. You stated that he, along with others, were confounding terms. Expound on that.
Yes. Well, people are confounding decriminalization with legalization. We've had a campaign that says decriminalize, don't legalize. And some people said, well, Kevin, wait a minute, you're the most anti-drug guy out there. You're saying that? And I said, yeah, we're not saying people should go to prison for smoking a joint. If you have an addiction, you shouldn't go to jail. That's not the first place that we need to be, you know, the first resort. That should be the last resort. We want to get you help. And said, if this is a health issue, you treat it like a real disease. Now, it's a behavioral disease, biobehavioral disease. So it's a little bit different than, you know, heart disease or something, but it's something that we will want to treat and prevent. And so absolutely, I don't want to see people behind bars. I think we went overboard 30 years ago with mandatory minimum sentencing. I can understand where people were coming from with that. And they were coming from a very different environment, but I don't think it's good now. It's not applicable now. I don't think people should be in prison or have records that prevent them from getting housing or healthcare, education or a job. I mean, how does that make sense? You got convicted for something 30 years ago for smoking a joint because you were in the wrong place at the wrong time, really, and probably the wrong skin color. And then now you still can't get a job to get your life back together. I mean, that makes absolutely no sense. So I agree with what the pardoning that's gone on. And it's different. Decriminalizing is different than legalizing. So that's just the thing that I think people need to understand. Legalize really means commercialize. And that's why Patrick Kennedy joined me on this and actually really had the idea to do this, to raise awareness about the negatives of commercializing today's high potency THC. I think RFK is misinformed. I think he's a smart guy. I think if we actually got in front of him and talked to him, you know, I don't know if he would be so strident in his views on this, but I think he probably sees it as also a way to get some extra votes. I don't think it matters, to be honest with you, Eric. I think that this campaign will be a footnote in history. So I don't think it really matters. But I think he does probably influence a lot of young people. And I wish his rhetoric would change. Absolutely. And I would love to talk to him about this. You know, obviously it's awkward because I don't think he has the greatest relationship with the rest of his cousins, right? And family. But I think that he's a smart guy. And I think that if he heard the truth on this, I actually think his rhetoric could change.
So I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Keith Straub of Normal. Between the late 1960s and early 1990s, pro-legalization attitudes fluctuated within a 15-point range from 12 to 27% approval. That approval rate is now at 70%. Why do you think there has been a shift in public opinion toward legalization? Mm-hmm.
So I'll answer that question, but I want to challenge the premise for a second, Eric. And that premise is that number is actually accurate. And let me tell you why I challenge that a little bit. When we do surveys with one of the best polling shops in the country, rated by the New York Times, I think they got an A rating, which is called Emerson College Polling, and nonpartisan. You know, it's not right or left. It's very moderate. They're really center. Their polling shows that when people are given the choice of decriminalization, which we just talked about is different than legalization, when it's about not arresting people or putting them in prison, which is what decriminalization is, whereas legalization says not only we're not going to do that, but we want to sell it to you, we want to advertise it, we want to commercialize it, we want a pot shop in your own community. Which, by the way, where are the pot shops in this country? They're centralized, focused in poorer communities of color. Surprise, surprise, right? That is exactly what happened with alcohol, cigarettes. It said you go to the poorer communities that have fewer supports to get lifelong customers. I think that's an environmental racism, if there ever is one, on the environment, not the climate, but the environment of behavior and of positive, you know, sort of future building for our young people. it's right there. It's structural racism right there. But the issue is, a lot of people choose decriminalization when they're given a choice. In the poll that you mentioned, which is they're also very good polls. I mean, Pew is very good, Gallup. I mean, I'm not questioning sort of like the nature of the poll, but the question I'm questioning actually is because I'm questioning it because it's just saying, do you believe in the legalization of marijuana use? It doesn't even ask about sales. It doesn't make a difference between decrim and legalization. So, you know, that I question. That being said, I'm not denying that the popularity of marijuana has increased in the last 40 years. So the nature of your question is still valid, right? The spirit of it is still valid because you're essentially, we can argue about the questioning. You're essentially saying, why has this become more popular? And it has, absolutely. It has because there's been a brilliant multi-billionaire funded campaign to normalize it in our country. So that they've gotten their money's worth. They've been able to change public opinion by distorting the science, which is what Big Tobacco did for 80 years, by promoting their product as fun and cool, which is what Big Tobacco did for 80 years, promoting it as medicine. So it's not only not bad for you, Eric, it's good for you. You should take it for your ailments. Big Tobacco did that for over 100 years. We used to have asthma cigarettes. If you're, none of us will remember that from the late 1800s. We used to have cigarettes for dental issues, cigarette. I mean, it's crazy what it used to be advertised for. Big Tobacco. We've had celebrity endorsements. Oh, well, Big Tobacco did that. They probably hired every single A-list actor to be in movies and smoke cigarettes in the 50s, et cetera. They did free giveaways and parties and conventions. Marijuana is doing that right now. So they're following the exact same playbook. So yeah, when you follow that playbook and you have a lot of money behind it, you can change public opinion. So kudos to the marijuana industry for doing that. They have successfully changed public opinion from what it was because they're following the same deceitful and deceiving tactics of Big Tobacco.
So you kind of touched on my next question a little bit, but I want you to go deeper. How is big marijuana preying on communities of color?
Well, it's preying on it in multiple ways. Number one, it's targeting communities of color, just like Big Tobacco did. And it's doing that by mainly trying to place pot shops in poorer communities. And there's been a lot of pushback. There is pushback on it. We worked with very closely, ironically, with Compton, California. They don't want to be known as marijuana, even though Snoop is from there. And the word chronic, I think, was coined in Compton. They don't want to be known for that. They want to be known for the fact that they have an incredible history in the Black movement and freedom in this country and business entrepreneurship. That's what they want to be known for. That's what they tell me they want to be known for. And so there have been exceptions like Compton, which has such a rich history, but that's an exception. Unfortunately, you go to places in Washington, D.C., you go to Baltimore, you go to different parts of L.A., you go to different parts of Northern California, and you see this concentration in poor communities and communities of color. So they want to go after the most vulnerable. And they've done that. They've also done that with some product placement and celebrity endorsement, but they've really done it with where these shops are located. And by the way, they've also done it in rhetoric by giving the false claim that we will release people from prison and jail and the war on drugs will be over and our imprisoning prison system will be a lot smaller if we legalize marijuana. And guess what? We've legalized marijuana in multiple states and the prison systems are not shrinking because of that. It was a completely deceitful, really wolf in sheep's clothing kind of argument.
Right. So let me go into that real quick. And now I want to come back on the race part. So this goes back to the vice president's original statement. What progress has been made in regards to criminal justice reform? Because like I said, I've had a couple of guests on that are for legalization. And my last guest that I had on dealing with it, basically said that the industry should be pushing for people have been sentenced for possession or selling marijuana or whatever. The cannabis industry should be lobbying that if you want to legalize in your state, that all those people need to be released. So talk to me about criminal justice reform and what you've been seeing.
Right. Well, the reality is that criminal justice reform is not marijuana legalization. The industry doesn't care about that. They just use it on slogans to get their laws passed so they can laugh all the way to the bank and make a lot of money. And by the way, they are accessing banks. So this sort of false premise that they can't access banks is illegal. There's hundreds of banks working with the pot industry. It's also a false, it's an invalid argument. They're doing the banking thing so they get investor money and they get billions of investment in a safe way. They're not doing it because they only have mountains of cash. Maybe some people do, but I guess those people are dumb enough not to find the, you know, hundreds and hundreds of banks which are willing to work with the pot industry. So I just want to put that thing aside for a minute. But it's not releasing people from prison. They don't want to do that. That's not what the industry cares, but they claim to want, but that's very hard. And by the way, you know, if you want to talk about people releasing people from prison or with records for marijuana, we need to be talking about the state level, not the federal level. The federal level hasn't had a person in there for marijuana's possession low level. I don't even know when the last time they did. Like there's nobody in the federal system who's smoking a joint and got caught unless they were on a public park and sort of maybe in a, you know, federal lands, and they were really at the wrong time they were there. But I don't even see the people like that. Even on the state level, marijuana only possession in prison is less than 1% of the whole state prison population. So let's be honest about why people are in prison. They're in prison for a lot of other reasons. Some of those are not good reasons. Okay. I'm admitting that. But let's talk about that. You want to talk about real criminal justice reform? You want to talk about the people serious about real criminal justice reform? Those people are not focusing on marijuana. The industry is focusing on marijuana because it's convenient and good argument for them.
So getting back to the race question, what do you say to critics that claim the only reason marijuana became illegal is because Mexican immigrants and Black folks smoked it?
Well, there are a lot of laws that unfortunately had a lot of racism, you know, as part of them. And I'm not denying that. And of course, that had to have been some part of it. But when you actually look at the history, and I'm doing that now for my next book, my last book was called Smokescreen, What the Marijuana Industry Doesn't Want You to Know. My next book is going to be called One Nation Under the Influence. And it's really talking about drug policy generally. But I do go into this history. First of all, Mexico banned marijuana before we did. So they saw the negative effects and banned it. Mexico did, the country of Mexico. So yes, this was being brought partly from Mexico, but we are really painting it too broad of a brush when we say that it was about jazz musicians and Mexican immigrants. That was part of it, must have been part of it. But you had leaders in those communities, by the way, talk about the negative effects of marijuana. You had the doctors talk about the negative effects of marijuana. You had negative effects cited for marijuana since the early 1800s, even before that. So the negative effects were well documented. And actually, interestingly, the drug sort of DEA type establishment of that time, of the basically 100 years ago, they weren't even interested in marijuana at first. They were very much focused on what was going on with the opium and heroin. They were not focused on cannabis. And then they became focused on it when basically a lot of people started complaining that this is actually a big issue. Yes, the racial element, I'm sure, helped them along. But we sometimes paint too broad of a brush, even if we say it was all because of those very horrible, hateful, terrible things. Let's admit that. Let's admit that, apologize for it. Let's make amends for it. Let's not repeat it. But let's look today why this would be, illegal, and why we shouldn't legalize it. And today we shouldn't legalize it because we are talking about something that is 20, 30 to 40 times stronger than it used to be. We are talking something that is, much more harmful than it ever was. We're talking about something that is affecting people, driving, workplace, brain, et cetera, in a way that it never was. And we are opening the door to create a new big tobacco. Let me be very clear. My issue is not with adults smoking a joint or eating a gummy in the privacy of their own home and then just like falling asleep. That's not my issue. If it was, I would say we should criminalize people for it, right? But I don't. I say we should remove the criminal penalties. I don't want to criminalize people for it. So that's fair. But my issue is with the commercialization, the promotion, the normalization. I sort of leave you with this analogy of a speed limit. You know, we have speed limits to discourage people from speeding, because when you speed, you're more likely to crash and have a problem, right? Do people speed anyway? Yes, they do. Do people speed and they're fine? Yes, they are. Do we need to put people in prison for speeding 10 miles over the speed limit? No, we don't. So we can think about this in a smarter way without going to sort of one extreme or the other. But what I don't think is a good idea is to say, if you pay a $100 tax, Eric, you can go 250 miles an hour. And we're going to put your tax towards building a new hospital to pay for any problems. That's sort of what we're doing with marijuana. That doesn't make any sense, because you're never going to, those fees will never pay for that hospital. You're going to destroy lives. You're going to increase dangerousness on the road. If you get rid of speed limits and just let people pay 150 bucks who want to speed, that doesn't make any sense. So I don't know why we'd want to encourage people to do something that's harmful to others. If they're doing it just to themselves and they do it without a problem, no one's giving them an issue for it. But that is very different than promoting it, normalizing it, commercializing it, industrializing it.
Yeah. So you took care of my last question for me. So that gives me time to ask you about the book you mentioned. When is that book coming mm-hmm. out? And this would be a good time for you to plug the organization and
sure.
how people can get Smokescreen. I think you sure. wrote another book prior to that. So just
I did. My
go ahead.
All right. So my first book. Yeah. So my first book is Reefer Sanity, Seven Great Myths About Marijuana. It goes through the myths. I wrote it when I left the Obama administration, because I served for 2.5 years in the Obama administration as a senior policy advisor. So when I left, I wrote that book. Then during the pandemic, I wrote another book. It was more of an independent investigation of the marijuana industry and its corruption. And it's called Smokescreen, What the Marijuana Industry Doesn't Want You to Know. Now I'm working on a book called One Nation Under the Influence. It'll be out next year at some point, 2025, looking at drug policy a lot more generally. People can get involved. They can go to our website, learn about SAM.org, Smart Approaches to Marijuana, learn about SAM. And we'd love to have people get involved. We have chapters all over the country. We have affiliates all over the country, people working to raise awareness with their local leaders, with their decision makers, with their state leaders. We have an annual conference early in the year. So there are a lot of different things we're doing.
Well, Dr. Kevin Sabet, I greatly appreciate you coming on. One of the things that I try to do with my show as compared to other shows is, regardless of what my political position or ideology may be, I want to get people on so that the listeners will have a fair shot. And so since I had some people pro-legalization on the show, sure. Especially your friend, Mr. Strope, I noticed you laugh when I mentioned his name.
I got to say, Mr. People like Keith Strope, I got to be honest with you. I think they came in with intentions. They just wanted to smoke weed in the 1970s and not get bothered about it and not get arrested. And I don't blame them. I mean, I wouldn't have done it, but I don't think it's a good thing to do. But I that's different. His movement has been hijacked. His movement has been completely hijacked by guys that look like me in suits with Harvard MBAs who never touch marijuana. They'd never want to touch it in their whole life, but they want to make money from it. So that when I talk to Keith Strop and I think about him, it's just so interesting to see how that's changed.
Yeah. Well, again, I wanted to make sure that when I had the opportunity to get somebody that may not agree with Mr. Strop and proponent. So sure. I'm glad that you took that opportunity, and I'm really, really honored to meet you and look forward to talking to you in the future on this podcast.
Happy to. Thanks so much, Eric. I appreciate it.
All right, guys. And we'll catch y'all on the other side. All right, and we are back. And so now it is time for my next guest, Malia C. Lazu. Malia C. Lazu is an award-winning tenured strategist in diversity and inclusion and a lecturer in the Technological Innovation, Entrepreneurship, and Strategic Management Group at the MIT Sloan School of Management. She is a former EVP and regional president of Berkshire Bank, and the creator of several accelerators designed to support minority-owned businesses in the Boston area, as well as the consultancy of the Lazo Group. She is the author of From Intention to Impact, A Practical Guide to Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. And that's from the MIT Press. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct honor and privilege to have as a guest on this podcast, Malia C. Lazo. All right, Malia Lazo, how you doing, ma'am? You doing good?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing lovely, Malia, as I've been instructed to call you. I'm really, really honored to have you on. One of my, even though this is a political show per se, one of my pet issues deals with diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think that this is a political issue, thanks to some of my conservative friends. And so anytime I get a chance to get somebody with some expertise and somebody who's written a book about it, I want to get them on the podcast to get their viewpoints. So that's one.
Thank you.
Number two, the first thing I do with a guest is I throw a quote at them. Right. And so it's either something that they might have written, something that they might have said, or something that relates to the work. So your quote is, "Unity, not uniformity, must be our aim. We attain unity from variety. Differences must be integrated, not absorbed, not annihilated." What does that quote mean to you?
I mean, I think it's reflective, right? I mean, I think it means it helps explain how we actually find one another, right? We don't find one another through sameness. We find one another by discovering who we are as individuals and what that interconnectivity is, right? In spite of us not needing to be the same.
So the name of your book is From Intention to Impact. And there's a person that you reference a lot, Charles Mills, I think his name is. And that was this particular quote was the one I was going to use, but I'm going to use it to ask a question I ask other DEI specialists. And that quote is, "Imagine an ignorance that resists, that fights back." That quote leads to the question, is DEI dying in your estimation?
I don't see how, I mean, you might need to change the words, right? I mean, I'm old enough to remember when it was affirmative action. There's people who are old enough to remember when it was called integration, right? This idea that somehow we're all going to just pack up and say like, oh, well, I guess the corporate ladder's not for me, or I guess, you know, I'm just not going to be valued here, is a really privileged stance. I mean, I think it really ignores that DEI are not just words, not just platitudes, but actually hard fought for philosophies that will build the U.S. economy and that will strengthen business, you know? So I love that Charles Mills quote, you know, it's in my book as well. And it's really unfortunate, you know, that we can't, I think it speaks to that ignorance, this idea that, oh, DEI is going to die. You know, like women didn't just go back home after they were told to in World War II, right?
That's right.
You know, and so as long as there's those of us who appreciate the ability to be valued and to bring value to society, I don't think you kill DEI.
Why did you decide to leave a position at Berkshire Bank to become a DEI consultant and advocate?
You know, at the time, well, so I should start to say that I didn't start off as a banker, right? I didn't have a goal to, you know, find my way up the corporate ladder and, you know, maybe be the CEO of a bank someday. And I went into the bank because I had an opportunity to make change, you know, to actually run a $1 billion P&L, to see how one could align business with values. And it was an amazing experience to do, but it was nothing that I had set out in my life to do, you know. So to get back, to be able to affecting change on a larger scale, is something that was going to be inevitable for me.
So how did Harry Belafonte influence your career?
You know, Harry, their integrity is a really hard thing, unfortunately, right? Like, and I mean, and I get it, right? We all understand those moments. But watching someone who gave up so much, not willingly, right? I mean, he would have loved to have been able to support civil rights and his career, right? And have his career. But the culture at the time wouldn't allow for that, right? So he gets blacklisted for supporting Martin Luther King. And he continued on with that integrity. So, you know, when I was working for him, I would see him take stands on issues and watch his speaking calendar evaporate, right? Like, and, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to say that Harry was broke, that wasn't it at all, but everyone should have a right to live, right, in this country and make a living. And so to watch him say the things he said and, you know, so often being on the right side of history, right? He went to Africa on those liberation struggles, right? He stood by what he believed, and that allowed him to be, to look historically very astute, right? First one to bring Nelson Mandela here. So working for living history like that and being able to see, you know, what it looks like day to day. I mean, when we started working, his office was in his apartment. I mean, I'm saying apartment, right? It was Upper West Side, beautiful, like in the, you know, public quarters of his apartment. But I got to see how he made those decisions every day and start learning a little bit about why and how. And I think that has really shaped the work that I do.
What do you see are the biggest barriers companies face to increase diversity in the workplace?
I think the biggest barrier is they don't believe it's actually valuable. You know, I think at the end of the day, this idea that leadership looks a certain way, right? That the smartest room is filled with straight white men from Ivy League schools, right? Like that's still a narrative. And you know, here's another quote, right? It's not what you don't know, but it's what you know to be true that just ain't so. This idea that diversity even needs to be pushed in this way shows how strong this narrative is, right? I mean, because when you look at who we talk about when we're talking about diversity, kind of everyone but straight white men. All right, like everyone else seems to be trying to get in. And you can't tell me that that's the most competitive way, you know, to run a business. But I think so often, because it is a room of straight white men, for them, it just makes sense. We're smart guys, right? We've made a lot of money for this company, right? What do we need them for? Right. And I think that's the biggest barrier to really embracing DEI on the corporate level. You know, and when we look at even the Supreme Court case that just came out, you know, I mean, the military was like, no, we're not going to do that. No, we're not about that. And, you know, in my book, I quote General Milley because I thought he spoke to, you know, situational awareness, right? Like the importance of learning about people in order to have a cohesive organization, right? In a competitive organization. And so, you know, it's unfortunate that DEI needs so much convincing because it seems like where it's most important, your biology, your revenue streams, your 401k, diversity makes the most sense.
Right. And, you know, you highlighted some studies that showed that companies that were more diverse were more profitable. And so if people are hung up in a capitalistic society about making money, it would seem like they would employ every strategy possible to make money legally. They'll do some illegal. Yeah. I mean, they will do some illegal before they would diversify their workplace, which I think is insane, but that's just me.
Right. And they have, right. And they have, I mean, it's, you know, and I think that's, you know, I've been talking a lot, obviously, about this with this book. And one of the things that comes up is, well, shouldn't businesses be doing this because it's the right thing to do? And I think so, right? But I also know that businesses do things for profits,
right?
Right. That's why they can poison air and water and things like that, right? And so if we're talking about strictly profit, and I tell you that McKinsey, right, not the NAACP, but McKinsey, you know, a global business consultancy firm, is saying that diverse teams are up to 36% more profitable. If that was a widget, you would have gotten it yesterday.
Right.
You're right. But it's that it actually, you need to change your narrative in order to do it. And I think that becomes really hard for people.
So explain the term demographic agnostic.
I mean, I think it is what it says, right? Demographic agnostic. You're not going to look at demographics of people. Maybe another way of saying it is colorblind, or, you know, blind to people's lived experiences, who they are. You know, I'm not sure what usefulness the term is, but that's what I would think it would mean.
Okay. In chapter 7, you talked about the 3 L's as a response to well-intentioned white people seeking assistance after the murder of George Floyd. What are the 3 L's, and how can that make us ready to enter any community?
So often when we're entering communities, there's, you know, just a general ignorance, right? I mean, like, we know this, if you've ever traveled, I mean, you don't even have to travel outside of this country, right? Go from, you know, the South to the North, right? Go from the East to the West, right? And there's things that you will learn about people. It's also important to be able to do that without burdening the communities that you want to learn from, right? I think that that's another important thing. And so the 3 L's is a process and a way for you to come in to a community and be in right relationship, right? Be as mutual as you can, right? And so the first is listen. Because people will tell you who they are, how they want to be treated, what they're looking at doing, what their agenda has been. You know, after George Floyd, so many white people thought that a well-intentioned question was, what can I do to help? Right? And the fact of the matter is what you could do to help has been being talked about 400 years now. Right. And so if you listened to the community, that question would already get answered for you. There would be a plethora of agendas, some which contradict, because guess what? We don't all agree on what we should be doing with ourselves. Right. Like, so come in, right? Hear our conversation, right? So I think the first L of listen, you know, like my mother says, you listen with a closed mouth, right? You let your ears and eyes do the working. And once you've listened and you sort of have somewhat of a cultural awareness, right? You understand the basics, right? You come in, and I should also say you listen. Well, I did say the community, like don't necessarily listen to a translated voice, right? But if you want to come into the Latino community, listen to Latino voices, right? Not to necessarily anthropological studies of them. But so the second step is learn, and you want to do that within the community, right? So you want to be able to not only talk, right, but physically learn, right? Like walk in, have that proximity experience, and learn what are some of the historical asks, right? What have people been asking for in a real way, and why? Why has that not happened? Get curious, right? Learn from curiosity. And then the last step is love, or take loving action. And I think this is where we so often fall down, especially as a corporation, right? Sometimes it's easier to do this as an individual. But loving action means doing something that I would appreciate. Right? Something that would mean something to me. Like we've all gotten gifts that have let you know this person doesn't really know you, you know, like, here's a candle. You're like, thanks. I live in an old house in Boston. I cannot have candles. But loving action is something that's useful. And, you know, after George Floyd, we have this example of people saying, what can we do? Right. We're having these conversations, and the outcome is the Juneteenth holiday, which is something that's special, right? You know, sacred in some ways, solemn, right, in ways. But that's not necessarily what the Black community was asking for, right? Like the conversation we were having was much more around police reform. Right. And equity there. And so while Juneteenth might seem like, oh, look, right, the U.S. has done something, they in fact didn't do what was being asked for. And so to think you can come in and, you know, I can't always be telling you what you should do it yourself, right? Like eventually, I'm going to want to listen and learn from you, and then help you live your best life. And it looks the same at the macro level.
Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to look at a political action as an act of love, but if President Biden had been more strident in pushing for the George Floyd Police Reform Act, as opposed to being so, what's the term I want to use, enthusiastic as far as pushing for Juneteenth, that would have been more appreciated in the community that was seeking.
Can you imagine?
Some kind of relief. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And it also would have been great if President Obama did it.
Oh, it'd been even better.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, we know we're not going to get it from Trump, but these police reform bills, there was probably the Emmett Till police reform bill, right? Like the police reform bills probably go back, right? The Klan Protection Act or whatever we were asking for back then, right? You know, so this idea of we can't, I don't want to be ungrateful. But I also think that we don't want to give too much credit for actions that aren't very helpful, you know. And I think if Biden, if Pelosi, right, if others use that moment, it would have been very helpful to our collective equity.
Yeah. And you know, you had a good example in the book about at the very beginning, talking about Walmart and the ice cream. I think that's an incredible story.
No one asked for that. No one asked for that.
Yeah, y'all got to read that one. That's how she kicks the book off. So I'm telling you, it's you'll get the tone right away when you read that introduction. Walk us through the seven stages from intention to impact that you introduce us to in chapter one, and tell us which stage is the most difficult for companies or clients.
Yes. So seven stages, and three of them are about pushback. And I think because that's really the most difficult thing, you know. And so the first three stages are what a lot of companies do, right? The first stage is, you know, you see that you can do something, right? You sign a pledge, right? You set a goal, you set an intention, right? And then there's energy about that. Yay, right? We signed a pledge, we're going to do something. So then maybe trainings happen, right? Something happens, right? We follow up on this thing. We talk about how we're going to make this real in the company, right? You know, and we start doing that. And that leads to stage three, which is taking action, right? On low-hanging fruit. You know, you've now had a training, you've had a strategy. Maybe there's a hire in your company and you're like, oh, well, maybe we can make this a diverse person, right? Or people want to start employee resource groups. And you're like, well, maybe that's something we can do, right? And give people a chance to share their experiences. And once you start taking action on low-hanging fruit, you start getting pushback. And that's stage four. And at first, the pushback seems like, well, we're just playing devil's advocate. Right. We have to see if we can get this through compliance. You know, we got to see if we have the money, you know, and you start seeing this pushback. And so at first, you know, stage four and getting is that you respond to the pushback. But then stage five is that the pushback keeps coming. Right. And you slowly realize that the pushback is actually the culture trying to right itself. It's that ignorance fighting back, right? And so stage five and getting to six is understanding, oh, this is the bias in our culture. It's not that there's no lady engineers. It's that we don't have the culture to compete and hire them, right? We can't find them. We can't compete for them. And so then we can't hire them. Right. And in stage six is when you really have to sit with, okay, this is the culture, right? I talked about in the book, Culture Eats Strategy for Breakfast, right? Peter Drucker quote. This is the culture pushing back. How much are we going to center that? Or are we actually going to choose to stick with our intention, which is to evolve the company to be competitive in the 21st century, right? And stage seven is choosing to do just that and moving through the bias and moving through the pushback, you know, pencils down, we're now going to activate the program.
Yeah. So what I'm seeing, and politics is playing a big role in that, is that most of these companies ain't making it through four, five, and six right now. It's looking really, really, and that's what leads me to ask you and anybody else that does this kind of work, that question, is it dying? Because it just doesn't seem like these companies have the moral will and fortitude to adjust to the pushback. And that's not just in the corporate world. That's just everywhere in American society.
That's
and
right.
And it was this guy, Milton Price Webster, one of my favorite quotes, he said, in America, if we just abandoned everything that was racist, then we wouldn't do anything in America. So we've got to do stuff. We got to try to break the barriers, but it just seems like the collective will has never been that strong. So how do you navigate through that?
You know, I come from an organizing background, right? You know, we talked about me working for Harry Belafonte earlier. And I think coming from that organizing background first allows me to understand that we will, that the end, this beloved community is the aspiration, right? And even if we were to get the race thing right, we then have, you know, LGBTQ, right? We have people with disability, right? Like there's so much there that we see even within our own internal communities, right? The disconnects and disagreements that we have. And so I think it's important for us to be realistic about what this work is. When I was a, you know, young organizer in the streets, I really did think we were saving the world. I really, really did. At 46, right, I now understand that what we're doing is putting our block, right? We're putting our brick in this road to liberation. And if I can do it in myself, I can help, you know, put the brick down, and I can feel good while doing that. I can find my own humanity, and everyone else, you know, I mean, good luck with you and your God, right? Like I think it's important for us to keep that reality in check, right? That at the end of the day, they will try to push back everything. I mean, when I started writing this book, I had more rights to my body than I do now.
Right.
Right. They, like, you know, wins always have to be pushed. Now there's another option. Right. And I think that that's also important for us to remember. I think this is even less popular. Right. Which is, we dust off Marcus Garvey's plans. Right. We decide to do something else. And I don't think that's a bad idea. I just don't think it's a very, I don't know where that idea is anchored right now in society, right? It's sort of like a solution looking for people, right? Versus the other way around. But I think that that's the ultimate answer, right? Is how do we actually decouple ourselves from the US, which is a white nationalist Christian, right? Like we know the things, right? They were very upfront about that from the beginning.
Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned Garvey and, you know, Booker T. Washington before him tried to do it in a way where we could be in the society, but we had our own thing going, right? They didn't like that. And, you know, I did a whole podcast on that because I was like going, it's like a bad relationship, right? You don't like me. You don't really like looking at me, but when I say I'm leaving, you won't let me leave either. And that's what they did with Garvey. They basically put him in jail so we wouldn't leave. Because if he had been left to his own devices, we'd probably be having this conversation in Ghana or Jamaica or somewhere like that.
That's right. You know, and that, I think that also is the answer for some people, right? I mean, there's several civil rights leaders and you know, movement leaders who moved to, right, Africa, who Tanzania, Ghana, right, Nigeria, who moved to France, right, Baldwin, Simone, you know, so I do think, again, there's the interconnectivity, and then there's what you need to do for your journey, and it is as important, right, for us to give ourselves our own humanity. And sometimes, you know, I have a friend who moved to Jamaica several years ago in 2018, you know, because she wanted to have the experience of not being a Black woman, right? She wanted to live in a place where that was not the first thing people thought when they saw her, right? That was not her identity. And one of the jokes she made is she was like, you know, now if someone doesn't like me, my first question is it because I'm Black, right? Like, it's like, oh, wait, I'm just getting poor customer service. Got it.
Well, I mean, the discrimination, if you want to call it that, in, or preference in other countries, is you're an American. They don't look at you as black.
Right.
You're an American, so you got to overcome that. All right, let's get back to the book real quick. I got a couple more questions. How can choosing vendors help build diverse ecosystems?
So I think we sleep on the value of vendors because we see them as a transactional, literally contractual, right, relationship. I need paper. I'm going to buy paper from Fleming Paper Supplies, and that's it. But if I actually get to know Fleming Paper Supplies, what I find out is that the owner, Mr. Eric Fleming, does the podcast, right? I find out that there's actually a lot of people that follow him in ways that might be helpful to the networks I'm trying to get into, right? So I can then ask Fleming Paper Supplies, hey, we're trying to do this other ancillary thing, right? We're looking for furniture, right? Like who's in your ecosystems, right? Because you probably know people, right, who can help me think through other ways that I'm trying to get into the WMBE community, right? Because the WMBE community is not just business owners, right? They're consumers, right? They're employees, they're mothers of employees, they're fathers of employees, right? They're embedded probably in who you're trying to sell your services to. And so understanding that vendors, part of the business relationship is continuing to do business together, right? So lean on that, right? Ask them, tell them about what you're looking for, right? What your vendor goals are. And see how they can help. You know, I think a community of practice going beyond just the chambers, which are great, but asking someone who they work with can really help diversify your vendors, even your employees, you know, things like if you're looking for accountants, they might know accountants, or you're looking to hire accountants, they might know accountants. I mean, you know, we know somebody. Right. We know somebody. Using that transactional relationship to build a deeper network is where I think the real value of vendor diversity sits.
So final question, as a DEI consultant, what do you see yourself doing 10 years from now?
Well, first of all, as a 46-year-old, 10 years from now, I really hope I'm, you know what I mean? I mean, in 10 years, can I be like already starting to look at like places to go to the beach a lot? Like, you know, 10 years from now, I'm going to be chilling, sir. Shoot. So I'm an organizer, right? Like that's ultimately what I am. You know, I talk about that in the book. Right now, for me, DEI is the civil rights movement in corporations. And that's where I've been working, right? So that's where I'm doing this work. But in 10 years from now, I really hope we're talking about Americans because we're talking about a global economy and we really understand this global interconnectedness, and understand the only way that we're maintaining any competitiveness that we will have in 10 years is because of diversity, equity, and inclusion, you know? So I hope I'm being able to, you know, look at resting, looking at, the golden years of 60s, which, right, you work all your life. You're like, when can this stop? I'm all about the nap ministry right now. I'm like, can we take a nap? But I do hope 10 years from now, we've learned a little something.
Well, probably this book selling and becoming a New York Times bestseller will help you achieve that goal. So this is your time to plug
from your lips to God's ears.
So this is your time to plug the book and how people can reach out to you and get in touch with you.
Thank you. So you can find me on the socials. Most of my socials are at Malia Lazu. And you can get the book at malialazu.com or at MIT Press.
All right. So Malia Lazu, it's been an honor and a privilege to talk to you. Thank you for coming on the podcast. And I wish you much success, not only with the book, but in achieving the goals that you set forth in helping America become America again, even if it's just through the corporate circle. So I thank you.
Thank you, sir. It's been a pleasure.
All right, guys. And we're going to catch y'all on the other side. All right. And we are back. So I want to thank Dr. Sabet and Ms. Lazu for coming on the podcast. I hope that y'all gained something from their viewpoints. Again, like I said, even if you don't agree with it, you know, you got to hear it, right? And I find it valuable for me to have people on that I may not necessarily agree with. And, you know, but it means a lot in the American discourse and to talk about things that we're not comfortable with, right? So, you know, if you know my politics, you know my position about legalization of marijuana, right? And if you know my politics, you know how in line I am with Ms. Lazu and her viewpoints. But nonetheless, whether I agree with them or whether I disagree with them, the beauty of this nation has always been that people have been allowed to express their viewpoint. And when we get into a political movement, for lack of a better term, or thought process, that we want to shut out voices, then we're no different than any other nation in the world. Our foundation was set up on free speech. It was one of the most unique things we offered to the world. And I take advantage of it through this podcast. I had the privilege of taking advantage of it as an elected official. And I think every American should have that right. And I think if we follow some principles that were outlined, especially listening, then we can get to the point where we can immerse ourselves and show each other love, right? So, you know, and it was a guy that once said that if you don't have love, then you can't be effective in government. If you don't love the people, then you can't do what you need to do for the people. So I'll leave y'all with that thought. And I thank you for coming on the podcast and listening. And until next time.